The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
Even the poorest people can be rich in music. Today on this special edition of the World Vision Report, we'll hear songs of rebellion, songs that inspire action, and songs that just make you want to dance. In Iran, women skirt the law by singing.
It makes me happy. It makes me sad. It makes me excited.
A violin teacher volunteers in a South African slum.
And I'll never forget that moment. There were about 800 children that put their hands in the air and shouted, "Teacher, please choose me." So I was like, oh dear.
And a hip-hop cry for a better Haiti. All that and more, including a visit from Wyclef Jean. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Today in our one-hour music special, we'll go from Kwaito to Cajun as we look at the role music plays in the lives of struggling people around the world. First, we begin in Iran. Under that country's interpretation of Islamic law, women don't have the right to sing in public. That's because it's considered provocative. Reporter Will Everett was in Iran recently. He brought back this story about a woman with a passion for singing and the teacher who's helping her find her voice.
Night has fallen on the city of Yazd in central Iran. The courtyard of the Mosher Garden Hotel is fragrant with honeysuckle and jasmine. A small group gathers around a woman in her late 30s who holds her hands before her as if in prayer. She begins to sing. Her name is Nargis. What she's doing might be considered illegal. That's because this garden could be viewed as a public space. And under Islamic law here, most public music performances by women are forbidden. Women can sing in groups, but solo performances are seen as sexually provocative.
In Islam, say it's bad for men. If listening to sing, a woman sing, it's bad for men.
So this is their interpretation.
That's Nargis's husband, Ismail Mirfakhri. Ismail is 2 decades older than his wife, who was only 11 at the time of the revolution. He remembers the days when women had a prominent place in Iranian music. Until 1979, their voices were heard in concerts and on the radio. With the Islamic Revolution, however, women largely lost the right to sing in public or even to record albums. But, he notes, women haven't lost their passion for music. They've just taken it behind closed doors.
In the parties, you know, in the houses, no, still it's going on. Many young Iranian women are just playing music instrument and they sing. But in public and radio, television, they have problem.
Nargis's talent hasn't gone entirely unnoticed. She's been hired to perform for parties at foreign embassies, where Iranian law doesn't apply. These are the only concerts she's ever given.
I'm so excited. Because the people listening to the Iranian music, they are so happy, they are so attention to the Iranian music. I had a good feeling.
Nargis arrives at the apartment of her voice teacher. The teacher is a woman in her late 40s, her long hair held in place by a swath of embroidered fabric, giving her the appearance of a fortune teller. The teacher's name is Shafar. She preferred that only her first name be used. 3 students are studying with Shafar today. The group meets for a couple of hours twice a week, each student paying about $5 a session. The traditional music Shafar teaches them is not notated. The lessons rely on imitation and memorization. Some of the women bring portable tape recorders so they can replay the sessions in private. Shafar, the teacher, has been studying music for 22 years. Because of Iranian law, she has never performed in public either. But like the other women gathered in her living room, she studies music because she can't imagine life without it.
I can't explain the feeling exactly. It makes me happy, it makes me sad, it makes me excited.
Iranian traditional music isn't like ordinary singing. Because much of the articulation takes place in the back of the throat, it requires special training. Since Shafar can't train her singers for careers on the stage, she encourages her students to experience the full joy of singing for its own sake.
The most important is to love it, because your instrument is here.
You know, the voice.
The voice. It's very, very important to feel deeply for something that you want to do it. Modern.
After a break, the women are joined by musicians who play traditional Persian instruments. Some of them are men who come to these musical evenings as a gesture of solidarity. This is a new song expressing contemporary feelings. While the women in this group don't say much about politics, the song is like a political anthem. The song takes place in a garden. A plant says to the wind, "Where are you going so fast? My feet are stuck in the dirt and I can't move. I'm frustrated with this. I want to go where you're going." In another month, student Nargis will be immigrating with her husband to Australia, leaving the constraints of Iranian life behind them. Nargis isn't sure where her music will take her, but she'll soon have the freedom to follow a dream that was nurtured in this small Tehran apartment for years. The other women will continue to train under Shafar, readying themselves for the possibility, however slight, that one day they'll have the chance to perform here in their own country. When asked if this will happen in her lifetime, their teacher, Shafar, offers an enigmatic smile.
"You never know, maybe."
And Shafar adds softly, "I hope so." For the World Vision Report, I'm Will Everett in Tehran, Iran.
Later on in the show, we'll have a reporter's notebook from Will. He'll tell us what happened when he urged a group of Iranian nomads to sing him a tune. You could say the Iranian singers we just heard were taking part in a rebellion of sorts. My next guest expresses that openly in her music. Tandiswa Muswai is a young singer from South Africa. Her music fuses reggae, gospel, and a South African urban style known as Kwaito. Tandiswa's lyrics don't shy away from difficult issues like poverty and HIV/AIDS. This is the title track from her solo album, Zabalaza. Little ghetto child. Let's jump right in and discuss the title song from your album. It actually means rebellion. Are you singing about rebellion?
I think a lot of my life as a Black South African is quite has to be quite rebellious. I'm lucky to be part of a generation that was able to see freedom in its own time. But I mean, it's always a struggle to define myself as a Black person in South Africa, as a Black person on the continent, and as a Black person in the world. It's not a very simple thing to do, and I think it requires a bit of rebellion.
Now, in this song, the lyrics say, "Babies are going to bed hungry, my peers are dying of AIDS, we sleep in shacks." And I would assume that's tied to the rebellion. Why these lyrics?
People don't think that there's a need for rebellion anymore. They think that because they have a Black government that things are okay, or that things will be okay. So this song is just to say to people, look at your lives, look at your struggles, and remember that the struggle continues.
Some might think that people who are living in this kind of situation don't really want to hear about sleeping in shacks and people dying of AIDS and babies going to bed hungry. How does your audience, especially young people, how do they respond to these kinds of songs?
Well, part of the reason why, I think the main reason why I do what I do is to have a conversation with my community and to have a conversation with my generation. And for the people who have bought my album and have listened to my album, what I find is that every time we meet, we have a conversation about our lives as South Africans, about our lives as Black people. So for me, it's had a very positive impact because it's caused people my age to question their lives and to question what kind of future they want to build for themselves and for the coming generations.
I'd like to listen to another song. I think it's called Lal Umlenze. Is that the correct way to pronounce
it? Lahlumlenze.
Let me try that. Lahlumlenze. Is that
yes,
better?
Lahlumlenze. Yes.
Lahlumlenze. What does that mean?
It means dance. You know, this song is basically a celebration of the fact that we as Africans dance and we sing and we stomp the ground and that we should be proud of that.
What are you saying there? What are these lyrics about?
You know, I think it's just speaks of the fact that as an African, I've always felt that I've had to assimilate to other people's cultures in order for me to be acceptable. And this song speaks of not necessarily changing, staying myself.
And what does it have to do with dance specifically?
Well, because dance is very important to Black people, and I think historically people have always wanted to make it look like something trivial. And it isn't trivial when Black people dance. Sometimes when we dance, we summon spirits from the past, and we, you know, we connect with God. So it's a very important part of being an African to dance and to sing.
Tandiswa, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
That song is called Transkei Moon. Tandiswa is an award-winning singer from South Africa. Coming up, we'll hear more from South Africa, where a string orchestra is changing the lives of its young musicians.
My name is Sesetu. I'm 11 years old, and I play violin.
Wait till you hear this rendition of Pachelbel's Canon. That story's ahead after a short break. You're listening to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. This is our one-hour music special. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Haiti is widely known as the poorest country in the Americas, but the tiny Caribbean island has one undeniable gold mine, its music. Haitian music has its own distinct sound and subject matter. Artists sing about politics, voodoo, and of course, love. But today, something new is catching on with the youth of Haiti's slums, hip-hop. And one famous Haitian-American singer is using the music to inspire young people to work for a better Haiti. From Port-au-Prince, Amy Bracken has this report.
When people in the slum of Cité Soleil want to celebrate, they make music from nothing. PVC pipes and tin funnels become horns, flattened metal on wires become cymbals. Today, people are making music to celebrate a visit from celebrity Haitian musicians. There's a compa singer and a reggae rapper, and there's the hip-hop star who moved to the U.S. when he was 9 years old, Wyclef Jean. Jean is emceeing an event sponsored by his nonprofit Yele Haiti Foundation. Yele, in collaboration with other groups, has put more than 1,700 people to work cleaning streets. Today, it's holding a Clean Streets hip-hop contest on an outdoor stage in Bel Air, another Port-au-Prince slum. There may be bona fide celebrities here, but no one rivets the crowd more than the kids featured in today's show.
Ça c'est caméléon.
Chameleon is the stage name of one of the 12 contestants sampling their work today. The streets must be cleaned, he cries. Too many people have died from the pollution. The finalists are all from Port-au-Prince's poorest neighborhoods. They will all appear on Haitian television in a live broadcast of the competition finale. Some of today's contestants broaden the subject of cleaning streets to Haiti's bigger environmental problems.
Yeah, yeah. DJ, drop the beat, please.
Jimmy Kidd raps about the deforestation that contributed to deadly floods in the towns of Gonaïves and Fonverette.
Est-ce que nous prêts?
Tout le monde crée mes âmes créoles, levez maintenant les. OK.
And Zam Creole, one of the youngest rappers in the show, proposes making Haiti beautiful again.
Oui, Haïti, c'est un petit pays qui était tellement belle.
He says Haiti was once so beautiful, they called it the beautiful island. Now it's so ugly, people are dying, violence makes no sense. Wyclef Jean says he was stunned by the enthusiasm and skills of the young performers.
I mean, I held my tears back because I'm a tough guy, but it was very emotional. It was hope in their eyes. I mean, it was rhyming with the determination. Like, they was rhyming like they're superstars in their own country, and the world just don't know who they are yet, but they're gonna know.
Yo, escape, sans faux choix, pas faux fait. Tu vois ce qui est clair, les mêmes gros squelettes, ça fait mes pieds.
Emmanuel Saint-Louis, aka Zamour, is a small 11-year-old orphan. On stage, he wears a red bandana, basketball jersey, and chains around his neck and wrists. He is one of the quickest and loudest rappers in the show.
When I'm grown up, I want to be the same thing I am today, an artist like Wyclef.
Emmanuel's favorite song is a Wyclef Jean hit called Vent Viré. The title is Creole for The Wind Has Switched Direction. The expression means change is afoot. Some of these young rappers, like 12-year-old Clifford René, believe music can bring about that change in Haiti.
Hip-hop is in my blood. When I see someone who can rap, it has a real impact on me. I like to see music develop Haiti, to bring together people, to inspire them to help their country.
Whether or not music can bring about change, for many Haitian youths, just being able to rap is a dream fulfilled. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amy Bracken in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
As you just heard, Wyclef Jean is the founder and force behind Yella Haiti. That's the charity that sponsored that hip-hop contest. We managed to catch up with Wyclef recently. I asked him why he put out a CD in Creole a few years back.
I made it just basically as a tribute to my country. The album is in Creole. It was important because I have a lot of big records, and it was like, okay, well, I wanted to do something that was in the native language. I have a lot of friends from all over the world that are not Haitian, and they're like, yo, we like Creole. It's a cool language.
And Haiti's the poorest country in the Americas, and I know you spent part of your childhood there. What do you remember most about growing up in Haiti, Wyclef?
I mean, what I remember about growing most in Haiti, I would say it's just the spirit of the people, the energy, the music, the culture, the art, you know, is a part that people don't really focus.
Do you think the music that you grew up with in Haiti has influenced your music today?
Definitely. I think rhythms that I heard in my country, I heard because the fact that I'm bilingual,
I think that helps because, you know, I have a different way where I would, like, English is like my second language, and it helps you write better because sometimes I think in Creole and I write in English.
You're an international recording artist, but you grew up in poverty in Haiti, and now you're one of the wealthiest Haitians in the world. Why have you decided to spend so much time going back to Haiti and get involved in the poverty there?
I mean, really, for me, you know, you live and you're going to die. You know, you have the small time in the middle. What's important is what you do with the middle. And the reason I feel that I'm in the position I'm in is to bring inspiration to people. So if you can't share a piece of your gift with humanity, then it's senseless to have that gift. I've been fortunate enough to been blessed to know that, you know what, if you want to do something, go back to your country and inspire these people because they need it.
Now, speaking of blessed, your father was a preacher. You spent some time as a young boy in a church band, and I understand you wear almost always a gold medallion of Jesus. Does God have anything to do with this for you?
I'm a missionary boy, you know what I mean? My dad is basically, he was a Nazarene minister. All of my chops come from the church, like a lot of, you know, artists. And I think for me, if some people, you know, they believe in the sun, you know, some believe in the moon, you know. But I think for me, without God, like in my life personally, like none of this would be possible at all.
You have a number of projects going on in Haiti, Wyclef, and some of them you're working with local musicians to actually distribute food in some of the most violent and poorest neighborhoods where other charitable groups can't even go because it's so dangerous. How do you get in there and deliver food? How do your people do it?
I think music is a very important tool because you have to understand no matter how rough the communities are, you still have the sports and you still have music. So if you go into the neighborhood, use the people that are in the neighborhood and say, okay, you know what? We want to come here. What do? You do music? Okay, well, let's have a hip-hop competition. Whoever wins, we'll put you on the radio. We'll put you on TV. We have our own television station in Haiti. So it's sort of like you take the negative and you make them change it into a positive.
Now, you've also been helping renovate schools there. You provide scholarships to kids so they can go to school because it's not free to go to school there. They're very poor, and yet they have to pay school fees. Mm-hmm. And now you're using hip-hop musicians to teach kids about HIV and AIDS. Mm. A lot of stuff going on. How are these projects coming along?
Excellent. The reason why is because the responsibilities, I have put it in the hands of the people. We have trained them and we've said, listen, this is the initiatives, but you guys are responsible. And they're like, wow, people really trust us like that and we won't let them down.
I know you know this. Western governments have been pouring billions of dollars into Haiti and things just don't seem to be getting much better. Do you ever feel discouraged that this is just going to be a blip on the screen and then it goes back to the way it's always been, which is a lot of despair and poverty and failure?
Well, I think that we in Yele, Haiti, we're the upcoming generation. We've been in Haiti and then we came to the United States, you know, we're what's considered to be the diasporas, you know. I just feel in the future, you know, if anybody's going to put in a lot of money in Haiti, look at what we're doing with Yele, Haiti. I wanted to say, you know, when Martin Luther King was marching, I felt like some people sometimes probably was like, man, you're marching, but don't you think it's probably going to be a blip on the wall, you know? And he didn't say these words, but this is how I envision it. He probably was like, well, as long as I can get it started and after me, it can continue. So I think that as long as I can get it started in a positive way, I think that it can continue.
Welcome to my country. When it's cold in New York.
Hip-hop artist Wyclef Jean is the founder of the organization Yele Haiti. For more information about his music or his work in Haiti, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org.
We gonna bounce the world with a new dance from the refugees.
1, 2, 3,
let's go.
Everybody do the compa.
Hold the weight.
Everybody do the compa.
Keep your hips in place.
Everybody do the compa.
2 steps get closer.
Everybody do the compa.
Wind your body like you know.
I see y'all do the Macarena. I see you dance to the salsa. I see you moving to the cha-cha slide.
bye bye, do the pom pom.
Oh, way, oh, way, oh.
People jumping out of the house.
We can't wait to dance. That's when they take over the land. So leave your guns and knives at home.
In South Africa, there's a suburb of Cape Town known as Hout Bay. It overlooks the water, and it's one of the most beautiful and expensive places in the region. But on a steep hillside there, thousands of poor people live in tin shacks clustered together. 3 years ago, a local music teacher began to volunteer her time there. Now, children who'd never seen a violin are performing at everything from weddings to state functions. Reporter Sue Valentine sent us this audio postcard of the Hout Bay Music Project.
My name is Hisetu. I'm 11 years old and I play violin. I love to play violin and I love the project.
My name is Anisia. I'm 10 years old this year. My favorite pieces are Bach and Chikile Maweni and Pachabel.
My name is Leanne Dolman and I started the Hout Bay Music Project in the middle of 2003. It was something I was going to do in my spare time. I thought I would teach a group of 4 or 5 children from Oranje Kloof Primary School. I know there are no extramural activities. They don't even have a blade of grass at their school. So a friend of mine and I, we went and demonstrated what a piano and a violin sound like together, the kinds of music they can play, how you play the instruments. The whole school was there in the burning sun in the playground, standing. And after the performance, I happily announced that I would be teaching children who were interested. And I'll never forget that moment. There were about 800 children that put their hands in the air and shouted, "Teacher, please choose me." So I was like, oh dear.
My name is Mfundo Manana. I'm 16 years old. I'm in grade 10 at Kensbury High School. And I play the double bass. I love the different strings and the sounds it makes.
They know the technique before they play pieces. The children know how to do a staccato, an up bow staccato, down bow staccato, legato, whatever. Picking up some Bach or something is not a problem because they have all those techniques at their disposal. It's just a case of playing the notes. Some of the really surprising moments in this project have been seeing the children fascinated with black and white, crackly old films that people have managed to put onto YouTube. And fascinated with the different styles of playing, comparing Milstein to Oistrakh to Tsigeti, and we can talk about technique, and so they talk about how they like this one's vibrato and this one's staccato, and then imitating the players and saying, now I'm playing like this one or that one.
My name is Lwazi Mkula and I'm 16 years old. At first, your fingers, like when you finish, they hurt very much, you see, like your knuckles.
Yeah.
It, like turn red like when it's your first time, yeah.
The piece is called Pachabel's Canon by a composer, Johann Pachabel.
Not just that.
moment, we're trying to get children into better schools. They're often in schools where the circumstances are not great, there's violence and great overcrowding. So we try to get them into better schools, find sponsorship for that, and once they've finished school, encourage them to study further, and not necessarily music. If they would like to study law or accounting or something like that, we're going to try and help them. We'd like them to come back and teach at the project and maybe receive some kind of remuneration for that and use that money while they're studying for whatever student expenses they have.
Best thing is that you meet new people, you learn new languages, because music is written in like Italian, you see. Now you learn a little bit of Italian, yeah, and you travel a lot. But hey, the worst thing is the long hours of practicing. Yeah, but it pays off at last, yeah.
That story was produced by Sue Valentine, a freelance reporter in Cape Town, South Africa. Coming up, we head to Cajun country. I'm Peggy Waymire, and this is the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report and our one-hour music special. I'm Peggy Waymire. In many places, when people who live in rural communities can't find jobs, they move to the city. That's where they find work as street vendors and factories and on construction sites. But in Indonesia's capital, rural migrants with musical talent have another option. Orlando de Guzman explains.
Jakarta is not for the faint-hearted. The traffic jams here are legendary. On the train at rush hour, every place is taken. Even the roof is packed with people. Inside, it's airless and hot. Hawkers push their way past passengers. But Jakarta has a soul as well. Just as a commute becomes unbearable, street musicians offer relief. The songs of buskers can be heard almost anywhere in the city, on trains and buses, in street stalls, and in the few seconds before a traffic light turns green. They sing of broken promises, of love, of hope, and of the struggle to stay afloat in this teeming metropolis. They also write their own songs, which offer biting critiques of the inequality and corruption in Indonesia. How long will politicians be this brutal, this song asks. How long will they come just to pummel us? No one knows exactly how many street buskers there are in Jakarta, but they've become a permanent fixture here. Like many, 19-year-old Fandi Vanessa came from the distant countryside. Fandi says he was scared at first, but quickly learned to survive. He first worked as a porter, then bought himself a guitar with the money he made and started singing to people to make his living. Fandi has cut a heart-shaped pick from the bottom of a discarded plastic cup and uses it to strum his ukulele. His favorite hangout is the platform of this train station in central Jakarta.
It's better to be a busker than a corrupt official. It's better than being a thief. Even though we're just buskers and people just see us as wretched street people, we're as human as anyone else.
But others in the city don't seem to see that. Jakarta officials consider the buskers vagrants and want the city rid of them. Fandi rolls up his pants to show a badly disfigured foot, a fracture that didn't heal properly.
I've been thrown off the train by the truancy police. Look at my foot. These days, it's people. People with the money that rule. Those at the bottom never enter people's minds. They don't matter.
Still, the hope of making a better life brings thousands of migrants to the city every day. That's what drew Rose here. She makes about $2 a day, which buys her breakfast and dinner. She sleeps most of the day in a small room in a Jakarta slum. And she hangs out with other fellow singers for protection. She says this isn't really the kind of life she wanted.
Who wants their future to be forever in the streets? We would like to be successful one day. But like it or not, this is what we have to do for now. Maybe it will change. Maybe tomorrow will be different.
A few buskers have made it big. Iwan Falls' CDs often top the local charts. His streetwise lyrics describe the pressing problems of Jakarta's urban poor. Gilang, a 16-year-old busker, says Iwan Falls is his hero.
He started from zero, but why was he able to create so many songs? He's like an inspiration to the rest of us. If Iwan Falls can be successful, hopefully we can too.
Gilang gathers his friends together to sing one of Iwan's songs. The guitar is bashed up, and the percussion consists of old paint cans. A few passersby stop to listen, dropping a few crumpled rupiah notes into an old can, but many more hurry past. It's the middle of the night, and the traffic has finally eased. Now, the singers' voices rise above the city's hum. For the World Vision Report, I'm Orlando de Guzman in Jakarta, Indonesia.
The Cajun people descended from poor French sharecroppers who moved to Nova Scotia in the 17th century. After the British expelled them from Canada, they fled south to Louisiana. Today, the Cajun people continue to live a mostly rural life. Many of them are poor. But for centuries, they've been rich in music. We invited musicians Steve Riley and David Greeley to talk to us about their community and their music. They're part of the band Steve Riley and the Mamou Playboys. As you'll hear, even the hurricanes of 2005 didn't stop the music. Talk to you both first about how you got involved playing Cajun music. Steve, let's start with you.
Well, I grew up in Mamou, Louisiana, which is a small town in south central Louisiana, and I grew up around the music from the time I was born. There are musicians on both sides of the family, and I grew up hearing them play along with legendary musicians from the community, from Mamou and Eunice, a nearby town. And my grandfather, on my mother's side, was very much involved in the happenings around town, the Mardi Gras celebration, the Cajun Festival in Mamou, and what have you. And he wasn't a musician, but he instilled a love of the music in me from a very young age. I started learning how to sing songs from him at about age 3.
All right, David, how about you? When did you start playing Cajun music, and why?
It's really about the fiddle for me, because when I was 17, I was a completely assimilated American kid. I went to New Orleans to see Black Sabbath play, and there was a band that opened for them that had a fiddler in it. And when I heard that, I went crazy. I said, I got to do that. So I went and got a fiddle the next day. My mother's family was really happy about it because my grandfather on that side used to play the fiddle. Since my grandfather was Cajun, I knew I was eventually going to have to learn Cajun music. And boy, when I heard that, I just went crazy. I got completely obsessed with Cajun music, and that's all I've ever cared about playing since.
When the Cajuns settled in Louisiana, there was still that theme of poverty in their communities. Has poverty influenced Cajun music?
I think it really has. One thing that they knew and that they shared was that life was hard. They didn't have any money. They had to work really hard to get by. And when Saturday night rolled around and it was time to play music, they gave it everything they had. It was a ritual that gave them a release from the hardship they had to go through every week.
Now, this makes me want to play a good dance song. Pick a good dance song on that album, and we'll pipe it up here.
Play the first cut, Domino.
Yeah.
What do the lyrics actually say?
Well, they're pretty impressionistic. He says, for a long time, there's something I'd like to understand. Where do the good ways come from? Where do good feelings come from? It's like a wave that touches families, one after another, like an echo.
Now, you guys are both still playing in the local dance halls in the area. Are people showing up in light of everything they've gone through and the hard times there right now?
Yeah, I think people are showing up even more than, in a lot of ways, even more than they were before the hurricane, you know? I mean, I think music is healing in times like this, and people want to hear it and people need it. You know, they need a good time to divert their attentions from what's going on day to day for them.
Did you all bring any instruments to the studio today?
We've got one fiddle.
Are you in the mood to play and sing anything for us?
We could do a little Pas de Nez à Boire or something like that.
Yeah, we can do something with one fiddle. We're going to do a song that we learned from Dewey Balfa and the Balfa Brothers, who are a huge influence on our music, especially in the early days. And this song is called Parlez-nous à boire, non pas du mariage. And that means let's talk about drinking, not about getting married. It says if you marry a pretty girl, you'll always be in danger of someone stealing her. If you marry an ugly girl, you're in danger of having to spend the rest of your life with her. If you marry a poor girl, you're in danger of having to work hard all of your life. And if you marry a rich girl, you're in danger of people accusing you of marrying for money. So let's talk about drinking, not about marriage.
Let's hear it. Steve Riley and David Greeley are with the group Steve Riley and the Mamou Playboys.
Pas de nous à boire, non pas de mariage, toujours en sont passés.
For almost an hour now, we've talked about the role of music in people's lives. To end the program, we bring you a story about what happens when there is no song to sing. Iran has a large nomadic population. Twice a year, these wanderers break camp and move their flocks of sheep to seasonal grazing lands. Will Everett was in the southwestern city of Shiraz during the spring migration. While there, he met up with a group of Bakhtiari women who were gathered at a popular shrine. We'll let him tell you what happened.
For the reporter in the field, getting people to open up is what it's all about. While I was traveling through Iran recently, I found that getting kids to open up was easy. All I had to do was ask them to sing, which Iranian children love to do. But while in Shiraz, I met a group of women who presented a challenge. I knew from their colorful head coverings that they were Bakhtiari nomads. But what really gave them away was their bare, calloused feet. When you see these nomads, it's usually along the side of a highway with a processional of sheep ahead of them, their tents piled on top of donkeys or camels. April is the month when many nomads relocate from winter to summer pastures, following routes that have remained virtually unchanged for thousands of years. I was at the tomb of the 13th century poet Sa'di, a pilgrimage point for many Iranians. The tomb was in a domed building, the centerpiece of a sprawling park where many had come to picnic on this warm spring afternoon. The Bakhtiari women, all very old, had walked many miles through the desert to come here. Iran is a country with a strong nomadic tradition, and yet I could see that the other Iranians visiting the shrine were not mixing with the nomad women. As I learned later, nomads occupy a low place in Iranian society. I had never spoken to an actual nomad. And as I approached the women, I saw them instinctively turn away, drawing up their chadors to hide their faces. When I realized they weren't going to talk to me, I asked them if perhaps they would sing. One said, "We didn't go to school. We didn't learn any songs." "Not even the village folk songs?" I asked. They were adamant. "No songs." But seeing that I too was something of an outsider, their tough, road-hardened exteriors began to soften. One looked me over closely. She seemed to be the leader of the bunch, a woman in her 70s or 80s with a craggy but kind face. She began reciting a long poem by Sa'di, whose tomb was just 20 feet away. It had probably been passed down to her through oral tradition, since most nomads are illiterate. It was a poem that clearly had great meaning to her. It spoke of how the heart can find no solace when away from one's love. Her oration captured the attention of the crowd, people who had studiously avoided these women before. The applause was unexpected, to the nomad women as much as myself. They asked where I was from and were amazed to meet someone from so far away. The lead woman then raised her hands and began reciting a Muslim prayer. The prayer was picked up by the others. It was mesmerizing. To myself as much as to the crowd, which was now pressing close around us. My translator whispered that the women were offering a benediction for safe travels, an invocation to the prophets and holy figures of Islam. As nomads, they knew the dangers that might await the traveler far from home. When they were finished, they gathered up their huge skirts and drifted out of the park. I'd taken a chance approaching these unusual women, and learned something that would stay with me throughout my journey in Iran. Take a chance. Approach the unapproachable. and you might just find a blessing.
Will Everett is a freelance producer based in Texas. And that brings us to the end of our show this week. Just a quick reminder that you can find us on the web at worldvisionreport.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. The show is produced by Beverly Abel. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is the production assistant. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.